Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
What's good, internet? It is April 24th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio coming to you live from Lobby One, Brooklyn, New York.
This is so much of an intro.
I'm trying to get energy again. It's Monday morning. I'm trying to keep two Mondays in a row. High energy.
Okay, I'm all for it.
Danica, I need to hear more energy.
Oh, I'm all for it. I'm still kind of sick, but I'm here. Monday, baby.
You missed the bus this
radio,
morning.
Baby. This morning I took an L, but tonight I'll bus back.
There it is. Rob Zachney also joining us.
So happy to be here on Monday. Oh my God, my energy level is through the roof. Do you see how happy I am to be here, Austin? Please don't fire me.
He's happy.
Okay. It is Monday, April 24th. I am Austin Walker. Joining me, Rob Zachney, Danica Herod. Danielle is in a meeting with a union, I think.
She's our union rep.
She's got to rep us.
Yes.
The union.
Yes.
She is
on a table right now holding union above her head.
Yes.
Yes. And like a foam one.
A foam number one, just also Yankees,
for
it says.
Union.
She's just a big Yankees fan, I think. Don't let her hear me say that because I know she's from New England. Patrick taking a day with the fam, which is always a good idea. So glad that he's getting some time to, I don't know, drive.
Mm-hmm.
What do dads do?
Hang out. Play ball.
They play ball. He's playing ball.
With his baby.
Hey, catch, baby. And he throws, what type of ball is it? A baseball, football?
It's probably like a tennis ball.
Hey, baby, catch.
Ball.
And then he throws the tennis ball.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then baby goes, caught it.
And she's like, I got it.
Yep. Jessica is going to be,
very small, but
she's going to be a pitcher.
I think you just described like the pilot episode of Pitch, by the way.
I think that's true. Uh-huh. Yep. Rob, how's it going up in Boston?
Oh, not too bad. I had a magical Sunday in which I ran into literally everybody I used to know in Boston who has since moved away.
Oh, it was there was a wedding up there.
Yeah, but I didn't know that.
Neck of the woods.
And so I was just like in a bookstore having coffee, and I run into a couple friends, and they're on their way to meet literally everybody I used to hang out with on a regular basis like 6 years ago. And so it was one of those very strange days where you slip back into all the old routines you had with your old group before all your lives changed enormously and got really freaking complicated.
Yeah, that's nice, or it can be nice as long as those routines are positive.
They absolutely were. This was definitely like a good thing and not like a sad Springsteen song.
Okay, I live for sad Springsteen songs.
Well, you are a Jersey
boy. That's like when I go home.
I'm a Jersey boy, and it shows. Which is also the first lyric to my favorite sad Springsteen song, I think. Danica, how was your weekend?
My weekend was fine. I've been sick for going on 9 days now, but
it's too long.
I'm almost there. I'm almost done.
Uh-huh.
I didn't leave the house for over a week. Like, I didn't step outside. So all weekend I stayed home.
just crammed inside with all that sickness.
You could say I'm down with the sickness.
There it is. What, did you fall into any bad habits over your 9 days stuck inside? Any old habits come back?
I made a lot of pancakes and I played a lot of Minecraft.
That sounds okay. Frankly.
I ate so many pancakes.
When was the last time you played Minecraft seriously?
I go back to Minecraft like at least once every 6 months or so. And I'll play for like a week or so.
Are you on vanilla Minecraft? Or are you like modded out?
No.
Okay, no mods.
I'm vanilla, no mods.
Okay.
My computer can't handle anything. I can't have any nice shaders.
You can't have like a cool witch's broom or
no.
That's my favorite thing I've ever done with Minecraft. Well, I've done a couple of favorite things, which is like I really like maps that are like quest maps or that have like a story or whatever. But I also just like downloading a big mod pack that's like, 15 different mod packs are in this one super mod pack. Mm-hmm. And then be like, all right, go. And then some shit happens that you just don't expect because – you don't know what the mods are. So, like, I was playing with a friend of mine once, and we had a big mod pack in. And we were just, like, exploring, and we came to, like, a castle with, like, castle grounds and, like, a tower where there was a lich at the top. And, like, we went through the whole thing. It was, like, a dungeon. And at the end, I found a recipe for a flying broomstick. And I was like, that's not... I was like, oh, well, you have to cast the spell with the – you have to draw the circle on the ground with the chalk.
Yeah.
And then you have to get, like, the five hairs of the five – and, like, what are you talking
about?
That's
so not Minecraft.
It's so not Minecraft.
It's so good,
but it was
though.
So cool to be, like – because it felt like finding a real magical, like, recipe or something. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh, yeah, I have no idea what any of this bullshit is. Like, okay, cool. And that was a really nice feeling.
Minecraft
so.
Is good. And they keep adding shit to the game. Mm-hmm. So, like, the map I'm on right now, like, I keep finding a bunch of ravines and I just went to hell last night, and there are a bunch of, like, new enemies that I've never seen before, and I found some castle in hell that
cool.
I was, like,
good.
Sprinting through and fought a bunch of blaze and got a bunch of blaze rods. Minecraft is good. It's good.
Are you a builder or are you more of, like, an explorer?
I am so bad at building. Like, creative mode is not my thing. I like to hunt.
Uh-huh.
And I like to, by hunt, I mean just, like, walk up to some pig that's in there
like,
and just kill it.
Yeah.
I like fighting enemies, and I like to, like, explore.
Okay.
So,
Rob,
mining is my shit. I love to mine.
Have you done any Minecraft?
No, because I always sort of felt like, so the Minecraft, craze took off, it kind of felt like you were divided into two classes, right? Like, you were either one of those, like, industrious creative souls who is like,
yeah.
I'm recreating the Commodore 64 inside of Minecraft. Or
you
were just some kind of, like, miserable taker who was just, like, playing adventures and, like, building castles in Minecraft. And, like, that's not creative. That's not the point of Minecraft. It can be whatever you want it to be, unless your imagination is impoverished. Is your imagination impoverished, Zachney?
Rob, there are two words in Minecraft, mine and craft.
Yes.
You can either be craft or you could be mine and, like, do mining, and that's it. That's fine. That's okay. You can take. It's in the name.
That's the good thing about, like, being on your own server with friends. Like, I am not for, like, public servers where there's a ton of rules and people come and they grief your shit and they steal from you, because that's happened. I'm way more into, like, being on a server with your friends and just, like, doing whatever you want. Also...
Yeah.
Rob, I'll send you a very inspirational Twitter video of a Minecraft rap where a kid is just like,
wrong.
Minecraft, or Mine Diamonds,
Ooh.
Minecraft, Mine Diamonds, yeah. And he does a dance. It's really good. It'll inspire you, you know?
I definitely feel inspired.
Okay, good. Monday, baby.
Speaking of going to hell, we're here now. Speaking of castles and finding castles, I actually been playing a game that I mentioned, like, once or twice. We've covered it on the site. It's called Unexplored,
mm-hmm.
and it's, like, the game I most want people to try to play, because I feel like it's one of those things that's – it's been a very busy first front of the year, and so little PC games don't get noticed very much. Jack DeKeat wrote about it for us in his column a couple of weeks ago, and I hadn't played it at that point. I was like, that sounds good, but it also sounds like the sort of thing where – Jack is a very evocative writer.
Mm-hmm.
I aspire to, like, paint pictures the way Jack does in my writing. And I know that sometimes in doing that, you can present a personal take that reflects your real experience, but that might not reflect what other people have with a game.
Yeah.
I've also hit that, obviously, with Stellaris in the past and other games where I'm like, I've had an incredible experience. That doesn't mean that you will. Sorry. But I finally got around to playing Unexplored, and I've settled into, like, a mode with it where it has become my go-to. I have 30 to 40 minutes to kill at night, and I'm trying to wind down, and I want to play something. It is a roguelite in the kind of – I guess in my mind, it's a little closer to traditional roguelikes in that, like, it's a dungeon exploring game. Mm. You're supposed to go deep into a dungeon and find an amulet or some bullshit and bring it back, and then you win.
Yeah.
And you have, like, a strength stat. And you don't really have a ton of stats, but you do have a strength stat and then, like, a set number of inventory slots and stuff like that. But it's an action roguelike in that you're in direct control. And I may have mentioned this briefly before. You're in direct control, and it's really smooth and fun, and, like, the combat is really precise and really deliberate. deliberate. It kind of has that thing that like Souls style games have of like, okay, every move counts because there's a cooldown after every attack. But the thing that's really incredible is just the way that the dungeons are generated. Mm-hmm. So the big thing with it is all of the levels of the dungeon are generated all at once, mm-hmm. whereas traditionally a lot of roguelikes have a thing where it's like, oh, you go into a level and it generates the dungeon of that level. And this, it does them all at once, and it knows what's like 12 levels down.
Yeah.
So that means that it can like start to almost like – it can kind of like lead you into that stuff. It can kind of like show you the barrel of the gun in a sense. So like on level 3, I found a book that says – fucking the Marine Magus, that guy is real trouble. I'm like, oh, I don't want to fucking deal with the Marine Magus. And like level 4,
well, you're gonna deal with the
right
Marine
at some
Magus,
point. At level
yeah.
4, I find a thing that's like a water sigil, and like, okay, well, if it's the Marine Magus, I bet he has water spells, so I can forge that into my armor, so that when I eventually find him, I'll be ready to fight him.
Yeah.
And like bit by bit,
so
and
it's
then
like setting you up,
it sets you up, and then it also does that just because it knows the Marine Magus is there. It dropped the water sigil at level 4 because it knows that I can use it to build armor. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's like the one way it does that, and it also just does like lots of good hub worlds. And the big thing for me, the thing that stuck out the most over the last week of playing, was that it really communicates geography in a way that a lot of roguelikes don't. Most roguelikes feel like box room, connect to box room, connect to
you're
box
not,
room.
And you're also not like paying attention or no. looking to pay attention to that kind of stuff.
No, you're like going into a room and killing the monsters yeah. and going to the next room and killing the monsters. Yeah. Especially like top-down traditional roguelike style stuff. And in this, there was this moment where I came into a new level and I stepped out and it was just a huge field of snow. And then there was like a smaller castle inside of that field of snow. This is why I thought of castles when you're talking about hell and castles. And like, oh, wow, like it feels like I'm in the fields outside of this castle and then I can go forward to it. Like I've never felt like in an open space in a roguelike like this before. I've only ever felt like the Binding of Isaac style, like here's the room you're in. Mm-hmm. Or even the – even you know, I've played a ton of roguelikes over the years. Even things like Dungeon Crawl. Like you feel like, okay, I'm in a room and then there's another room next to it.
Yeah.
Or here when I finally got to the Marine Magus, like, oh, it's a huge underground cavernous lake, and the whole center of the level is a lake. That was a cool fight. I just think people are going to, like, skip it because it has a really bad name. Unexplored is a terrible name. Or it's, like, an okay name, but it's not a name that's going to catch anybody's eye. Yeah. I'm going to try to do a stream of it at some point soon because I
that
really love
fun.
It.
I'm going to check it out.
You should.
I'm, like, very into roguelikes.
And, you would like it,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
It's really fun to throw things. Like, ah, it's just – it just feels good.
It
just feels good. Speaking of Stellaris, though.
Yeah.
Rob, you told me you were still playing that, and that surprised me.
Yeah.
You seemed not down on it, but you seemed like, I don't know, where are you at?
So the thing I wrote last week was in part driven by two things. One, the internet's insatiable need for content. But two, the fact that we had an interesting, like watching how you related to Stellaris sort of made mm-hmm. me reflect on like why I didn't have that relationship with it. And so,
right.
like, I still feel like Stellaris doesn't do a great job of getting across some of the things that I really love in a space, in a sci-fi game, which is, like, you know, some world building, giving you an idea for there being a life to the universe outside the game mechanics. However, as space, like, grand strategy games go, it's still pretty good.
Right.
I've been, you know, sort of taking my little empire of noble bears, of science bears. To glory, basically because while we sort of lost the horse race for colonizing the stars, we did corner the market on terraforming rare resources.
Ooh.
In a lot of strategy games, there's this dichotomy. You can be a broad or a wide empire, or a deep or a tall empire, right? So Are you a mile wide and an inch deep, or are you foot wide and
a
miles
giant,
deep? Yeah,
right. And right.
And so that's kind of the direction I'm going. Is I've taken my slightly impoverished corner of space and have started turning it into this like new Eden. As I'm taking just every single planet and making it like literally the perfect habitat for my species, and I can do
right.
that really fast and really cheaply. Terraforming is hugely expensive in this game, but I can do it. Austin, I can do it for 850 energy credits. I can.
That's no money.
Like usually, it's like 5,000 to get something to continental
yeah.
level.
How do you? You just happen to have? You just teched it in that direction.
I think it's because I control three different terraforming resources, and so
okay.
each
so
one.
Like all, so like the way. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So like, there's a resource that's like, oh, I have this resource, which means it's easier for me to terraform. Is it by planet or is it just a total discount? I forget.
It's by planet.
Okay. So it's like, oh, like desert. This makes desert planets easier to terraform.
Oh, no, 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 like no. I think it's universal. So it is universal in that regard.
Oh, okay. Cool.
It is more expensive to take a planet that's super unhospitable and turn it into like a temperate continental world, right? Gotcha. So like it's easy to take an ocean planet and make it temperate, but it's way harder to take an arid rock and make it habitable. So this is what I've been doing is I've sort of been creating this this sort of utopian playground for my empire that's also started to let us... Oh, the other thing my people did is we totally went the sentient AI direction with things.
Okay, so you have robots that can
didn't
vote
build
now?
The robots.
Can your robots?
Didn't build the robots. Oh. Except what? You can have the sentient AI and get the research bonus without robots. However, I had a science faction that was like, we really want the robots. What if you built some robots?
That's Austin. That's Austin's faction.
So I built one robot on this far empire, this far planet on the edge of the empire. The minute I built that robot, they were like, cool, we have robots. That's all we wanted, man.
We got robots.
But now they're like, we'd really like if we had more robots. What if we had more robots doing manual labor? And I was like,
that sounds good.
It doesn't sound good because we got sentient AI. Like if we build a bunch of robots, right. It's going to be like literally a week before they're also forming a union. And then a week after that, we're against the wall. We're against the wall.
Maybe you could just integrate the robots, or maybe you could work for the robots. They're really good.
I am not against integrating. I've actually got open borders. Like, for whatever reason, other species aren't attracted to my territory.
No, to the bears and robots, they're not thrilled with.
Nobody's like, you know what?
Science bears.
Nobody's like, I think a better life awaits me among the bears and the robot slaves. Like nobody.
That's the colony. That's the off-world colony from Blade Runner. Right? A better life awaits. And then what you didn't see is on the other side of that blimp was a picture of a bear in a lab coat. With a robot next to it,
so I'm not actually sure what we're headed towards. And this is the weird thing about a lot of these games, is that I feel like so many of their mechanics point in the direction of conflict. That when mm-hmm. there's not a lot of grounds for conflict in a universe, you start to run into problems of like, what are we doing here? Like what are we all playing this game for? And I played like a bite-sized game of Stellaris. It's a smaller galaxy. I'm in a federation with the most powerful faction in the game. I'm the most technologically advanced. That third guy we've got in our faction, I'm sure he's doing something great. like he is a valuable player.
I think he just like puts out really good TV shows. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's the place where just like, listen, y'all got Space Westworld? Shit's good.
The third guy did, like, he was like, what if we just killed these space religious zealots who are in the middle of our federation who hate us all? And
okay,
everyone else was like, yeah, let's do it. And I was like, I guess if we're doing this, like, I'll send some,
you'll go along with it.
But the problem is, once I did that, I built this huge fleet. Now I got a huge fleet, and I'm kind of wondering like what I could get up to with a huge fleet, and don't want to be stay with the friends with these guys. But the problem is, it's not that big a galaxy. I'm in this huge like alliance where we all love each other. And
there's no conflict for you that is like engaging at this point, because you keep resolving any problems that come.
Right. So now I'm just basically, I think, playing for
Is this
endgame?
Your first time through? Is this the first, like, is this the deepest you've gotten into a Stellaris game?
It might be. It's definitely the deepest I've gotten since launch.
Since like launch.
Like I missed all the in-between patches.
What I will say is, I think that Utopia, the most recent update, was like all about making the mid-game more interesting. The end game, there was always a chance to get interesting because they have like, I forget what their terminology is for it, but basically
crisis,
like, the crisis, galactic crisis, where like, oh yeah, something goes bad. That could be that your AI becomes like hyper-sentient and hyper-aware and build themselves into a future like Terminator state. Or it could be weird creatures come out of a void somewhere. And I'm hoping your game gets to one of those sooner than later, because those tend to be like the thing that the Federation butts up against. Like a strong Federation can butt up against that and not be prepared for it. And like, even though like you're able to mop the floor with all of the space zealots and all of your, you know, the hyper capitalists who are trying to like use their banks to bury your Federation. Like, yeah, those guys aren't a problem. You're strong enough to deal with them. But when the Void Talkers come through the Dark Gate, like, oh, fuck. Like, our fleet is not big enough for the Void Talkers. And then you have to deal with those. I don't think they're actually called the Void Talkers. I forget what they're actually called.
But, I mean, that would be good if they were.
Speaking of Void Talkers, really quick, I want to shout out a new podcast.
Oh, yeah.
By Motherboard. Motherboard.vice.com, obviously, is our website here at Vice about technology and mm-hmm. science and culture.
Hackers.
And hackers. What else? What else is the
putting,
environment?
Putting Switch controllers up your butt.
Okay, we're going to move on.
That was
that you
an
said
article.
That one. There's a new podcast coming out. It's called Science Solved It. It is a quote, a deep dive into the world's greatest mysteries that were solved by science. It's brought to you by the Motherboard staff. It's hosted by staff writer Kaylee Rogers. I know this because I was on the first episode, and the first episode, briefly just as a setup, is about the bloop. Do you know what the bloop is?
I know because I watched the trailer.
Okay. Rob, do you know about the bloop?
I have no idea. Is this like a 90s kids show thing?
Yes. No. Oh. Not a kid show.
Almost.
When I was growing up in the late 90s, early 2000s, scientists found this sound, this weird bloop. This is why I bring up the in relation to the Void Talkers. There was just this, like, underwater somewhere, there was this strange bloop. And one of the things that people thought was, is it Cthulhu? And so I'm on this podcast talking about Cthulhu. And I think we have a clip that we're going to play in a second. Yeah, hold your question until you hear the promo in which I talk about Cthulhu. I was sure it was Cthulhu.
That might explain why one of the most prominent theories surrounding the bloop came from the world of horror sci-fi master H.P. Lovecraft, the sea monster Cthulhu. To learn more about this creature, I spoke to Austin Walker. He's the editor-in-chief of Vice's gaming site, Waypoint. Austin is well-versed in a lot of pop culture, and that includes literature like H.P. Lovecraft, who created Cthulhu. Or is it Cthulhu?
The characters in this kind of big Cthulhu mythos, we can't pronounce them correctly. Like, I say Cthulhu, and anybody who's going to write in and correct me is wrong, because Lovecraft is pretty clear you can't pronounce those names because we don't have tentacles and 30 tongues. And there's, like, Cthulhu. There's Cthulhu. The C-T-H can be just, like, Cthulhu.
However you pronounce it, Cthulhu is an unimaginably massive sea creature that featured in Lovecraft's 1928 short story, The Call of Cthulhu. When the bloop became public, Lovecraft fans couldn't help but make the connection between this loud, unidentified call from the deep and their favorite Lovecraftian creature.
It's not like, oh, it made a bloop. The descriptions of the sorts of sounds it makes generally are related to in terms of effect. It and other old gods, the old ones, whatever, the deep ones, whatever you want to call the various creatures of Lovecraft's mythos, make sounds that drive people mad, that obsess people, that are unexplainable, that can't be related to other categories of sound that we already have. And in that way, like, the bloop is, again, a perfect fit. Part of why young teen Austin loved the bloop story was like, ooh, it could be anything. All right, so that is Science Solved It, and that is available. There's like a preview episode that you can go subscribe to right now on all of your podcast purveyors.
There's also a clip of the preview with subtitles on our Twitter. So if you go to our Twitter, we retweeted a Motherboard tweet.
Awesome. Twitter is twitter.com/waypoint.
Yes.
So, and then tomorrow, that full episode will come out, and you can hear me talk about Cthulhu. You can also hear a real scientist who's like, no, dog, like, I know what that is. We figured it out.
I don't want to hear that, though.
That's why it's called Science Solved It, is we solved it. We figured it out. We're not just fools.
No, I want it to be Cthulhu.
No, you don't.
I do.
You do not. I promise.
I never want any of that stuff solved.
That's fair. I get that. I get the desire to not want, like, to want some mystery in life.
Yeah.
I'm not going to spoil it. You'll have to listen.
Okay.
Rob, what's your beef with me and Cthulhu?
Look, I have no beef with you and Cthulhu. I want you guys to be happy together. Like, really, like, Mazel Tov, my best wishes for you. I guess I'm more curious about the fact that there was a purported need for science to solve Cthulhu, because somebody heard a noise on an underwater recording device.
The sound was weird.
So you're a skeptic. So you are a skeptic.
It was weird, and they were like, well, it ain't the things that we think it is. It doesn't match the things that we think it is.
I personally love the fact that people automatically were like, this is related to Cthulhu.
Well, because it fit. Okay, so there's a bit in there that I didn't bring up, which is like the, I believe like the coordinates were close to where.
To 1,500
kilometers.
To hell. Yeah. They were close to where Cthulhu was supposed to have been in the ocean, basically. Yeah. Cthulhu's from the stars, of course, but then crash landed on Earth and fell into the ocean. And they crashed a ship into. Okay. H.P. Lovecraft, huge racist.
Anyway, it's science.
Contributed a lot.
Not the racism.
Anyway, science.
The Cthulhu mythos.
Right. Correct. Speaking of things that have problematic content that you still like, we actually got a couple of questions very similar about this. Yeah. I think Lovecraft is actually a really adequate jumping off point to this, right? Like, Lovecraft is someone who's written a lot of very important sci-fi and horror, who's contributed a lot to the notion of cosmic horror. Mm-hmm. Also wrote many stories in which the horrific twist was that black people slept with white people.
Yes.
Had a cat named Nigger Man.
Ooh.
Yeah. That's a thing.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. That's
Boy,
a thing
I guess
he
when
did.
You put it all like that,
the
stories
when I lay
sound
it out
less
like
rad.
That. Uh-huh.
Oh, my
but
God.
But you can be in a situation where you're like, oh, there's still something here that I want to salvage. And I bring this up because we got two questions in that I'm going to read right now. This first one comes in from Tom from Jersey. I don't know if it's from New Jersey or maybe from the island of Jersey out in Europe. I don't. This is a kind of a tricky question to ask, says Tom. So apologies in advance if this is a little confusing. Y'all have mentioned on the podcast how there are games that you love that have segments that you don't really like that weirdly transphobic part of the Gerudo quest in Breath of the Wild. I'm currently playing Persona 5, and while I love the game so far, it's frustrating that it falls into a lot of the same tropes as other Japanese games do. Like female nudity, gay stereotypes that are played for laughs. When the subject gets brought up online, the most common excuse is, well, that sort of stuff is ingrained in Japanese culture, so you just have to deal with it. Some people go as far to say that if the sexist and homophobic jokes in Japanese games bother you, then you shouldn't play them to begin with. I personally really enjoy games like Persona and Zelda, but since these games are being made for global audiences, I think it's justified to call out these scenes as sexist or homophobic, regardless of how it's perceived in Japan. On one forum, someone went as far as to call me a xenophobe for wanting to push Western ideas, quote-unquote, on an Eastern-made product, which I personally think is ridiculous. I also want to mention that despite your and my hatred of Yosuke from Persona 4 for his homophobic tendencies, a pre-Persona 5 character poll in Japan actually had him as the number one most popular Persona character, so clearly that kind of character has appeal over there. But that poll also had fucking Adachi as number 3, so maybe the Japanese Persona fans are just, I don't know. Adachi has his fans, is what I'll say. So my question is this. What is your response to this kind of excuse for problematic content in Japanese games? Mainly the idea that because sexist and homophobic jokes are more accepted in Japanese culture, it's just something that Westerners have to deal with in Japanese games, regardless of our personal views on the subject. And I'll just add briefly from another question, then we can kind of combine the two. I'm not going to read this whole second one, though. But Aaron from Dublin in Ireland writes that she's also playing Persona 5 right now with her boyfriend, and that like it has satisfying gameplay and cool characters and awesome music, but also gay panic, transphobia. It's constantly sexualizing its female characters. There's like sketchy stuff where you're trying to fix a neurodivergent character. Like, there's all this stuff here, and Aaron wants to know what to do about that. She writes, I don't know what to do with it because it's so enjoyable, but how do I deal with it? There's talk about voting with your wallet sometimes, but we've already bought the game, and I have doubts of the effectiveness on that small scale. Do we address Atlas directly? Do we talk about it on social media as much as possible in the hopes of catching their attention? Do we just give up on a series because I don't think things would get worse than Teddy, but I seem to have been wrong. Danica, you've dealt a lot with Japanese companies and content in your life.
Yes. So one of the things that I can tell you from my experience working at Crunchyroll and my experience like traveling to Japan and working with content publishers, a lot of this stuff is somewhat ingrained in Japanese culture. Like, a lot of this stuff was not taboo in Japan. Mm-hmm. And you sad because you're out of coffee? You had a coffee?
That's okay.
One of the things, this is specific to anime, that heavily influences choices that are made in Japan are people consuming the content. Like, Japanese publishers pay a lot of attention to numbers. Social media has, like, been huge over the last few years. So being loud on social media does reach people. My personal take on stuff is there's a lot of content out there. The creators could like be problematic somehow. Like the creator of Attack on Titan,
mm-hmm. right,
is like believes in imperialism and like
yep,
that's starting to come through in the manga and like that in itself is problematic. Does that mean I don't enjoy Attack on Titan? No, I do enjoy Attack on Titan while also keeping in mind
this guy's
views. And
like,
it's the same as
for it, like kind of looking for it in the piece, or like are you able
like,
to fully...
I'm not looking for it, no. Okay. It's like I know this thing exists. I watch the content, like I watch the show. Am I thinking about Hajime Isayama while I'm watching the show? No, I'm not.
That's the guy's
but
name.
Hajime Isayama. But I am thinking about it sometimes. It's also the same as like the person who wrote Gundam Unicorn.
Right.
Believes in the same shit.
Yep. Which is like super weird for that show because that show has such a anyway.
One of the things also though is you're constantly seeing people being like destroyed on social media for enjoying these things by people who are so paying such close attention to the creators or paying such close attention to like a thing that happens in the game.
Counterpoint though is like y'all like. Japan has gay people. A lot of the pushback that I see from people who issue – so people issue social critique and then you get the pushback from fans who say like, yeah, it's just that's how it is in Japan. Japan is just homophobic and you were not allowed to be
–
Oh, yeah. I am sure the people making that argument have really done the homework on like
how other cultures handle
these issues. I'm sure they're just interested in it from an anthropological standpoint. And appreciating the diversity of peoples and beliefs on this beautiful planet.
Yeah. Also, stuff in Japan has gotten much better over the years.
Right. Like, that's the actual thing for me is like there's actually a really from the research I have done when these questions come up, like a kind of emerging and exploding queer scene in Japan.
Oh yeah.
Where like incredible people are doing incredible things, and the sort of notion of like, oh no, that's Japan doesn't have an issue with that right now, quote unquote, is like very disturbing to me.
My friend and her girlfriend just got their like same sex partnership certificate like the other day, mm-hmm. which is something that is only recognized in like a certain number of wards in Japan. Wards are like counties.
Right.
But the fact that that's even like being recognized at all is a huge step forward for Japan. Like, Japan is getting better. And I also don't think it's good to use the excuse of this stuff is ingrained in Japanese culture.
Right.
Like, just deal with it.
Right. Well, so we actually just had a piece go up by a freelancer, Emma Kidwell, who is Japanese-American, also grew up in Japan, and kind of takes down this notion that the monoculture of Japan is this perfect clean thing, which is ironic because Persona 5 also takes that aim on Japan as being a kind of a place that has problems socially, politically, but then also falls into these specific traps. Mm-hmm. I guess from my perspective, the other thing is speaks to Tom's original question is like, yes, there are global audiences. One of the things, the first things that I wrote, I think that got eyes on it was a piece about Animal Crossing, A New Leaf for DS, and the fact that I had to literally tan in that game to have dark skin. I had to like spend hours underneath the sun in that game in order to make my character's skin match mine and then maintain that. It was really weird. But a lot of the case that I heard was like, well, you're American. This game doesn't apply to you, basically. Like, yeah, but like Americans buy this game. We're part of the consumer base. And Nintendo, it's Nintendo.
They're not making games strictly for Japanese audiences. Like, regardless of what people think, like, content is not being made only for Japanese audiences. They want to sell this shit all over.
And then when Animal Crossing Happy Home Designer came out, you could choose skin color.
Yeah.
And so, like, to me, like,
who knows? What do you think? What do you think into that?
I think that they went into, like, thinking about what their global audience looked like and a small way in which they could appeal to people like me and other people who wanted to have black and brown characters. And I don't think that that's too much to ask for from a company that's providing you something. And I don't think that that is cultural imperialism. I don't think that, like, hey, it's not like Japan has not had its own strange history with race, right? Like, and troubling history with race. Like, it's not like Japanese ethnicity hasn't been a contested thing that in which they have also had to engaged in issues of racism and sort of bordering off what counts as truly Japanese. Mm-hmm. Like, if you study this stuff, you'll see a history of that.
Yeah. So what do you do then? Like, what do you do?
So me, like, I write about it and talk about it and have historically done that. It's what I do with Animal Crossing. It's what I do when I play something that's like, oh, I really love this thing, but here's this really big problem. Because the thing is, like, I fucking adore Animal Crossing New Leaf. Like, it was – I only did that because I loved playing that game and wanted to keep playing that game and wanted to see myself reflected in that world. So I do my best to speak out about that stuff.
Yeah.
But I guess my question ends up being like, is there a line for either of you where you're like, this is too far. I can't – whatever my enjoyment level is, I can't get over something that's in this game that I don't like, or that maybe the whole quality of the game isn't there where like you're – enthused enough about it that you're willing to forgive those problems or not even forgive, but
so wrong. Just this is as an example of something I went through like pretty recently. I like cars. I like racing games. I used to be really into Top Gear. Like, and Jeremy Clarkson was a pretty witty commentator on cars and a decent writer. And I was able to write off a lot as tone deafness.
Sure.
Until it became clear that after a certain point, he'd heard the critiques. He just didn't give a shit. And neither did anyone else involved with that show. And then I took a couple years off, and I thought I was past it, and I didn't really, you know, I was willing to sort of deal with them on their terms, almost. Or I tried to make that bargain, and I was feeling a little nostalgic, and I gave their show on Amazon a shot, The Grand Tour. And within like 10 minutes, I was like, oh, this is unbearable. Like, because it turned out that once you saw it, once you realized that it wasn't obliviousness, it was complete indifference, and to a degree, almost glee in like sort of wallowing in the stereotypes and the laziness, that the entire thing became tainted. Now there was no single joke. There was no single goof that they could pull that you couldn't also read all these other meanings into it. And for me, that is the moment where like it truly breaks for me. Is I think I can play something like right now I'm working through Persona 4. I can play that and like deal with the fact that Yosuke is kind of clueless, because one, the character is clueless as hell, so you can always say, well, that guy's an idiot. But two, it doesn't feel like you don't get the sense of there being like a persistent malice in Persona 4. What I think is starting to get uncomfortable with Persona 5 is that it's kind of pointing to some of these issues, but then it's turning around and saying, but we can still have our homophobic humor, right? That's still funny.
Right.
And right. I don't know, like Persona 5, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people do feel starting to cross that line where now it's starting to seem malicious. If it comes up in the next Persona game, it's that circle you're gonna that room to run is way more constrained.
Right. I think about this stuff a lot when it comes to both, hey, the creator's politics are weird, and the work itself has rough politics in it, in which I think there is, for me, a certain calculus that is about what I'm doing with my time, and it's not an up and down, clean, clear, simple thing. Like, it's not clean math. It is like blurry, and there are times when I fall on one side of it, and my professional curiosity sees me through something because I want to write about it or because I want to experience it. And other times when I'm like, I could be spending my time on something else. There's this, what I come back to again and again is this exchange between an anonymous question asker and then Gail Simone, the comics writer, and then John Darnielle from The Mountain Goats. An anonymous person asks, what's wrong with being willing to separate an author from their work? Why is that so hard? Especially Ender's Game, which aside from one or two lines from some stupid boys in the book, holds next to none of Card's horrible views. You shouldn't bar good literature just because the author is a terrible person. And Gail Simone says, do what you want. I will choose to do the same. Orson Scott Card is not just a raging homophobe. He actively worked to enact legislation to oppress rights for LGBTQ people. He said he would try to bring down the government if they disagreed. Seriously, screw that guy. There are 1,000 books I haven't yet read that don't have that guy attached. And then John Darnielle adds, this is exactly my position on this kind of thing, by the way. I don't need to separate an author from his work if the author's a truly terrible human being. Nobody's perfect. I don't ask anybody to be perfect. I just ask them to, you know, not be Nazis or virulent homophobes. But if they are, then I don't care how good their work is purported to be. I don't have to listen to Burzum. There's no shortage of amazing black men metal that isn't written by racist murderers. The amount of tremendous black metal that meets the appallingly horrible person yardstick is sufficient to excuse me from having to listen to the stuff that's made by assholes. So when people go into the I separate the art from the artist thing, I'm like, why? If we live several lifetimes, we should all be so lucky. We won't read all the good books or hear all of the great music. We can allow our artists to be human and make mistakes, and even big, huge, everybody has their personal lows mistakes, while still saying artists who are just worthless garbage as people who actively and unapologetically campaign to make others' lives worse don't deserve to have their work read. We will not actually miss much. We can put our attention elsewhere. There is no shortage of amazing books to read, incredible music to hear. Unless one wants to claim, no, these terrible people artists are actually the best artists, in which case I think one might want to more closely examine one's aesthetics. Mm-hmm. And like that to me is where I end up falling, which is like for – this isn't why I'm not diving back into Persona necessarily, but it is weighing on the decision a little bit. Like for every hour I put into Persona, that is something I could be putting into Unexplored or into something else that I've never heard of that comes from a creator who – I don't know what their politics are. I don't know what the politics of the Persona – of the Atlas dev team is either. I'm not making any claim about that. But I am claiming what I've read from people about the homophobia in that game and from the kind of like weird stuff around neurodivergence. That is a sort of thing that has to come in my mind. It's like, where am I spending my time?
Yeah.
Do I want to play this new weird project? Do I want to play Edith Finch, or do I want to play this, which is a mystery to me, and for my time playing with it, like, seems really interesting, and like, it could have some fresh themes and ideas, or do I want to go back to this thing that, like, I have a real great fondness for in Persona 5, but that has these issues that I can't quite get over. Like, every few hours, I'm going to be like, And it's a tough thing. And I don't think there's one right answer for everybody necessarily.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely something that I, having not played Horizon until after our interview with the creators.
Yeah, it was the developers. Yeah.
Where we talked about like the use of the term brave and right. all of that. I didn't start playing Horizon until after that had come out. So I knew about how they felt. I knew.
Can you give like a little context?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Text on what that was.
So,
I'll pull a quote.
They talked about the use of the term brave, and in the piece, there wasn't really an acknowledgement of it being any type of like misuse,
right.
And instead was just like people are too sensitive.
Mm-hmm. So there was Dia, I actually don't know the pronunciation, Dia Lucina, a Native American writer, highlighted the game's use of terms like Braves, which is the collective noun used for Nora, the lead characters, that is the first cultures, the Noras, warriors, savages, primal, and tribes being, if not disrespectful, then certainly not afforded due consideration given the historical connotation for Native Americans. And then in the interview with John Gonzalez, the narrative director of the game, he says, you know, talking about the term, quote, brave, with that in particular, our research into it was that it was not a term that would seem to be offensive. We were trying to find a term that would combine the capabilities of a warrior and the capabilities of a hunter. It was a term that we felt was not derogatory. We came across some terms that were definitely slurs against Native Americans and other groups throughout history, and so our decision was based on brave not being a hot-button term. And in general, the argument that he makes is like this, we were not appropriating anything here, and we tried to pick a term that was not offensive.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, say they're not appropriating anything. So that was a weird thing of like, just sending mixed messages, y'all.
And while I didn't agree with the stuff that he said in that interview, I went into the game and it was a thing I thought about like the whole first part of the game. I was like, wow, most of this tribe is white and like they're all calling themselves braves, and I just kept coming back to this interview and thinking about this interview. So I think for me, where there's content that is not necessarily super problematic. There's like these few little things here and there that are not the best use of like a word or something like that. It's just something I think about and something that I also try to talk about, like on Twitter or whatever,
right,
you know?
Right. Yeah, it's a weird thing. Rob, do you run into this with strategy games ever where you're like, I was making a face, people at home.
So, yeah, you run into a lot of things. You run into a lot of things in strategy games. There's the fact that the entire 4X genre is predicated on the understanding of the world as expressed by like 15th and 16th century like European colonialists and genocidists. That's sort of baked into a lot of those games is like, hey, there's an entire world out there for you to explore and inhabit, and there is in no way anyone else out there who lives there and who has any sort of rights as a person you should respect. And sometimes that gets a little more explicit. There was this moment a few years ago where a bunch of us were at this multiplayer event for EU4 just before it came out, Europa Universalis 4. And I was talking to Paul Dean from Shut Up and Sit Down, a great board gaming show on YouTube, and a really sweet guy. Like, Paul is one of the gentlest souls you'll ever meet. And over lunch, he's talking about what he got up to controlling, I want to say, Sweden up in Scandinavia in the Middle Ages, which was ethnically cleansing the Finnish people out of existence. Like, that's what he did in that game. Because there were penalties from having this, like, restive minority in his empire, and you can spend a lot of your resources to sort of scrub cultures out of existence in your empire. You can do that. And eventually they just go away. After a lot of bad things happen between the start of that process and the end. And it occurred to us both, as we're sitting there, like, That's a really horrifying thing you can get up to in this game. That's a horrifying thing. It's also part of history for a lot of
It's part of history which you're playing as
right, and you don't have to like
or
the game.
Through.
And this is the weird thing: is it a neutral thing to model some of the ways that like empires have eliminated? I don't like, and it's a really complicated thing. I like games that try to face that stuff head on, though, rather than, like, there's an honesty to EU4, I think, that you don't find in a game like Civilization or a lot of 4Xs that pretend that none of these issues even exist, that there's nothing political at all about this entire open world where you can create an empire and that doesn't have to hurt anyone. So that's I mean, that's a pretty clear case of, you know, some of the routine minefields that you run into with historical strategy.
Totally. Like, it's we ran a piece a couple of months ago now, I think. Maybe it wasn't. It was, like, when you first started, like, a month ago now, Rob, called How Board Games Handle Slavery by Sam Desitoff. And one of the examples in that was, like, oh, in the game Puerto Rico by Andreas Seyfarth, you know, it takes place in the Caribbean in the 15th century, and instead of having slaves, you have quote unquote colonists, which are like in the game's world basically just slaves. Like, they don't require any resources, basically. They just produce things for you. They fill the role that slaves
do. Also, they come on boats, and I think they are the only brown counters in the game.
They're the only brown counters, and there are a bunch of them. Yes, correct. It completely whitewashes it and attempts to sidestep it entirely, and that feels really untrue, and like it doesn't engage with that mechanic at all because of that, and like or that with that dark history, right? Like, with that very troubled history. And so like you have to tackle this stuff, and it can be difficult to tackle. I think in Persona 5's case, for instance, like, it's trying to do something when it tries to include a narrative about sexual assault. I don't know that it sticks the landing on it. And I think for me as a critic, the space that I try to occupy is one in which I want to encourage developers to take chances to tackle really difficult issues, but to know that doing that bears responsibility, and that it means that when it comes out, will not have a problem criticizing if they misstep. And that does not mean that they shouldn't continue to try new things. In most cases, I'm not going to be here calling for boycott, right?
Yeah.
I'm not saying don't buy Puerto Rico, the board game. I'm saying they fucked up. I'm not saying don't buy Persona 5. I'm saying, like, please let Atlas know if you're not comfortable with this stuff. I think that that's like the best we can do in our positions. Mm-hmm. And I think it's up to each person as an individual where they feel comfortable. And really sitting down and saying, what can I do to voice my displeasure if I have displeasure?
And I think there's also a big difference between engaging with something that is made by a person who, like, is just a genuine, like, awful,
yes,
genuinely awful person than it is to interact with a piece of content that has some stuff that maybe isn't being tackled the right way. You don't really know, like, where their intent lies. Mm-hmm.
I think there's
a difference. It's like, I don't listen to the Chainsmokers because they're misogynistic assholes and have, like, voiced their misogyny and have, like, you know, voiced a lot of awful shit, and that's why I don't listen to them.
Right. Also, their music's bad.
Everyone
needs
bad.
To read but, that thing like, that Noisy ran, is, like, a couple weeks ago about
so
the Chainsmokers,
good.
By
Larry,
the way.
Larry Fitzmaurice, shout out to Larry, wrote an incredible piece about
that
the chain
group.
Yep.
But we listen to Migos, right?
It's true.
And like, this is the fucking difficulty of being a person who has political opinions and who has and understands. Like, it is very difficult. It is difficult to figure out where we draw the lines.
Yeah.
And we are not rational beings. We are not consistent. We are, like, deeply inconsistent. And I do my best to address that head on and admit that instead of trying to pretend that I have some, like, set of rules that breaks it down. I don't know. I don't think that it's, like, necessarily the most clean answer. Like, but for me, recognizing the messiness and then, like,
definitely,
and doing your best to be engaged and not, like, passive.
Yeah.
And being aware of the actions you're making is the best thing to do. And saying, like, for me, this is like, I eat meat. I don't have a good argument for why I eat meat other than I like it a bunch. I think it's wrong. I think it's like, I think farming in America is shitty and the world is shitty. I think, like, I probably think it's bad to kill things that are alive and sentient, and I still eat meat, and it's a fucking mistake, but I'm going to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. And I need to, like, square myself with being that sort of person a little bit and continue living my life and doing well where I'm better at doing well and doing good where I'm better at doing good. So I don't know. That's me. Someone wants to know how we got here, not to this part of our conversation, but to kind of this part in our career where we're able to try to, like, tackle questions like this. Again, we kind of got two questions from two different people that are very similar, so I'm gonna mash them together again. This person comes in and says there was no name attached. So, hey, Waypoint, I'll try to be concise. I flunked out of my first semester of college 4 years ago. Since then, I've taken GE classes at a community college, and I'm almost done. There are two major issues. The first is I still have no idea what job I want to end up with. The second is that I may have to spend 2 years at Burnout U to be cleared to go to a university that I can be proud of. It is in a very isolated place, and it's not cheap, and it's discouraging me from going back. Meanwhile, the thought of what my career and social life should be by now fills me with existential dread. At this point, I have a hard time telling myself that things will get better. That's fueling an apathy that threatens to overtake my life, thus this email. So, questions, here we go. One, have you ever worried you'll wake up and realize you've been running in place your whole life? Your lives are in full throttle right now, and I'm curious how much momentum led you to this point. Were you always hopping from one career stepping stone to the next since high school? If not, how did you find purpose again when you lacked direction and or drive? That last one's the third one. So,
I think people are often surprised when I talk to them about my personal experience of getting to where I am, like, career-wise. I went to junior college. I didn't, like, graduate from a college. I don't have a college degree. And that's always been one thing that's, like, kind of embarrassing for me to talk about because, like, the companies that I've worked for, a lot of the people have had degrees, you know. But I have a finance background. Like, I got into finance because I just have been working since I was 16 years old. Yeah. I knew when I was young I wanted to live on my own and make money and, like, do stuff for myself. And that was the biggest driving force in, like, just continuing to work hard. And because I started working when I was so young, it was, like, I had all this random experience that I kind of just, like, put together when I got into finance. And then that finance experience is what led me to my position at Crunchyroll, and then a position in marketing at Crunchyroll opened up, and like because we were still a startup, it was like you can do whatever you want.
Right.
If you like have some knowledge about this and you can like show us that you can make this a good product, you can just do it. And that's like what I did, and now I'm here.
And now you're here.
I feel like I can look at my resume and people can look at my resume and feel impressed, and like I definitely feel good about like all the things that I've done in my history of working. And there have absolutely been times where I was like, should I go back to school? Mm-hmm. Should I do this? Like, what do I do right now? And I think for the most part, I haven't really ever had like a really strict plan for where I was gonna go
and
that has always worked out for me. Like I'm big on like taking risks and like if an opportunity presents itself, like going for that opportunity, obviously like weighing pros and cons and stuff like that, but I've always been relatively impulsive up until I was about 25, and that always worked out
totally.
So
Rob, what was your path like? Did you have like a 10-year plan? Because I've always thought of you up until I know that you had a job before us and like a full-time gig before us, and then obviously you're full-time here, but for years I thought of you as like one of the hardest working freelancers in video games, which is a fucking hustle. Man, it's you have to bust your ass.
I'm not entirely sure this email wasn't sent by like past me. Like this might actually be like
true.
Yeah.
Same.
No, and I think so. There's something really pernicious that happens around the time you turn 20, which is that the delta between where you're at in your life and how you feel about the direction it's taking, and all the bullshit you've been told by your parents and guidance counselors and all that stuff really begins to take its toll. Because throughout your teen years, everyone is telling you that you need this 10-year plan.
Mm-hmm.
And that like, oh, that you know, what college you get into is going to determine the course of your life. Well, what you do with that college education is going to determine the course of your life. It can have an influence. But the thing is, standing at the other side of my 20s, there was no map. There was no, like, I was off script by the time I was 22. And then I was off script again when I was 26 or 27. Like, life is confusing and complicated. And what I have learned is that you don't necessarily make plans. You just try to do things that will maximize your good options. And right. I would not sweat being in the place that this letter writer is at, because it's a thing that like there's going to be a lot of external expectations that are going to make that feel shitty, but you're so young and there's so many moves you can still make, and if you just keep maximizing your options and opening doors, eventually things begin to break your way.
What do you mean by that when you say like maximizing options?
Okay, so the reason I was pretty successful as a freelancer, and I don't say that to like, I'm not trying to boast. It's a very difficult job.
You're bragging, I get it.
It's a very difficult job to make a living wage. And it's an even more difficult job to make sort of a middle class income, and I managed to do that. But the thing that I learned throughout a lot of that process is that you never want all your plans and all your direction to be hanging on one or two things going your way. The place I was happiest to be was sort of standing in the middle of a lot of interesting and intriguing directions for me to go, and then committing to one, following that until more options opened up. And then seeing, you know, taking that survey again. Like, never, like, I never felt like I had arrived anywhere. I never felt like there was an end goal I was heading towards. For me, the thing that really interested me was always being in that place where it's a lot like in Heat, where De Niro's character is.
It's
never always. Have anything you can't walk out on.
Yep.
That was kind of my approach. Like, always be in that position that if something goes wrong, you know what your next move is. That was me.
Yep.
Yeah. It's really hard. So, you know, someone actually brings this up in the chat and says being open to opportunities is hard work in itself. I graduated from undergrad in 07 and then was unemployed for a year and then did a bunch of jobs that I hated and then tried to get into games writing and it was miserable and broke. And that was a decade ago, right? That was a long time now, and I spent a lot of time. I left college thinking that I was hot shit because I did okay in college. I wasn't even like a straight A student or anything. You know what I mean? Like, I did well in my field. I did well in philosophy. I got into grad school and then got hyper intimidated and was broke and dropped out. And then sold myself on the notion that like what I want to do is work, because that was an easy way for me to compartmentalize the depression I had about dropping out of grad school. And then I worked my ass off to just try to like get my name out there. And the thing that I will say that's sort of connected to you, your thing on opportunities, Rob, is like try to build relationships with people that you respect. And what that means is not pestering them necessarily, but it does mean willing to be visible, taking meetings, meeting people, going to that extra class, like, you know, going to a professor's office hours, talking to them about internship opportunities or work over, you know, work that you can do when the semester is over if you're still in school. If you can hang out over the summer break and take an extra class with them there. Things like those relationships are the things that eventually will pay off, whether that's a professional relationship or not, right? Like if someone at your job is going to a conference that you think is interesting, see if you can go to that conference. Mm-hmm. If there's a project at your office that's interesting, do that. If you're working retail, I worked retail my whole life.
I worked retail when I was young too, yeah.
Absolutely. And so like the things that I learned from retail were like how to talk to people that you don't know, how to be comfortable speaking with people, how to sell someone something. And that often does not mean how to sell them jeans. It means like how to sell them the idea that you know.
How to sell them on things.
Right, exactly.
General.
And then also, how do I look at numbers and how do I work my head around projections and like what we're doing down the road? When I worked at a comic store, it was like, well, what's selling, what's not selling, what's going to sell, obviously. And like that stuff is when you give yourself the interest in those things, you can develop those skills that can pay off way later. And those aren't even skills sometimes. It's just, again, you know, what Fox here said in the chat, it's about opening yourself up to the possibility that you could do that sort of thing. It isn't like, oh, I came to Waypoint knowing how to run a website, but I was comfortable with all of the skill sets that I would need to develop. And because I'd done so many of them in various roles before, that I was like, okay, I could wrap my head around this if I needed to.
It's like picking things from everywhere you've been, everywhere you've worked, like all of your experiences, and like putting those together in a nice like package
and,
that works for you.
Right. And often a lot of them you're going to have to leave behind because they don't work out.
And like, also you're going to fuck up.
I fuck up a lot. I dropped out of grad school twice. Like, don't get it wrong. Right. I did okay. I got my master's and then dropped out again later. Like, it's not, there are no straight lines to success. Mm-hmm. And also there's no like gleaming thing called success for most of us anyway. I'm blessed to have a lot of great fans. I'm thrilled to be working with incredible people. I know I've got it. I don't know what y'all on, but like at the same time, I feel like this isn't like I didn't cross the finish line. Yeah. Every day there's new challenges.
Yeah, and I also feel like
there is fucking painting tape all through this wall or all around this room. We turn the camera.
There's a ladder in here.
There's a ladder somewhere. Like, it's not. We're always building shit.
I also feel like this is something I ran into a lot at Crunchyroll. People thought like Crunchyroll was like this place in the sky that you couldn't work at, or that like my job was just like some sentient thing. Like, it, like people feel like it's not something that they can accomplish. It's not something that they can do. And they also tend to look at it as like it's the best thing in the world. And I think
it's
important.
Sweet.
Yeah, it is. It's awesome.
But
I think it's important for people to know that like we're doing something really cool. We have been like working so hard and like it's not always fun, you know? And
that isn't.
It's really hard sometimes.
There's that. I've come back to this one scene in The Wire. Every time anyone talks to me about wanting to get into games journalism or wanting to find the perfect job for them, there's a scene I think in season four, maybe it was all the way in season five, in which Lester Freeman, who is kind of positioned in that show as the veteran cop who has like you know, old black cop wisdom. Like, that's kind
of once every season, like, he has to drop a lot of knowledge on someone out of the blue.
Right. Exactly. And in this case, it's Jimmy McNulty, the fuck up, ultra persistent, who is like, basically, we're going to bust this one wide open, Lester. We're gonna save the city, right? And Lester Freeman's like, and then what? Like, you think there's going to be a parade? And
Jimmy
then everyone's going to say, yay.
Day.
Jimmy McNulty Day, exactly. And then what? If that happens, what's the next day?
Yeah.
And you know, where Lester ends up is the job will not save you. Like, yes, it will pay your bills. Yes, it will make sure that there's food on the table. Yes, it will give you something to have professional pride in. But, like, the notion that finding the job at Crunchyroll or at Waypoint or at Giant Bomb or, like, finding the job of your dreams is going to suddenly be, like, happily ever after mode. Mm-hmm. It isn't. And instead, for me, the goal has never been find the place where I'm happy forever. It's build the set of skills and practices and beliefs and habits that make whatever shitty challenge comes up tomorrow a thing I can manage.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And use the internet, please. Because, like,
use that internet.
When I, like, 10 years ago, when I was, like, learning the skills that I am very thankful that I have now, like, learning how to be really good at Excel was
true.
Me going to seminars that costed a lot of money, but mm-hmm. it was like, hey, I want to learn this skill. I can't Google this right now.
Yep.
Like, I can't do that. Use the internet. And also, like, God, if Twitter had existed, imagine if Twitter was
no,
a thing.
No, it would be bad. I would have fucked up. Like, I would have
you
fucked
think
up
so?
The way that a lot of people do, right? Which is like, someone tweets at me, someone applies for a job or an internship and then tweets at me like, I'll see you in a couple weeks, boss. And like, I get it. You're fucking out there. You're hustling. But like.
But not even,
there
not
is
even
not
like that.
Always. Oh,
not even like that.
Okay.
But there are people on Twitter and like people like us who are constantly talking about like what it's like doing this. Like, what it's like, what you can expect
mm-hmm.
out of X, Y, and Z. And I feel like there's so much that you can learn
totally.
From
absolutely.
Existing on Twitter.
Nickus in chat says, you probably shouldn't tell your employer that the job is not your endpoint, though. Sure, don't get fired by being like, I'm not here for life
yeah.
or whatever. But what you should tell your boss is, I need professional development.
Yeah.
I want to keep going. Where am I in 5 years yeah. at this company if I'm going to be here? What skills do I not know now that you would appreciate mm-hmm. me knowing? What sort of tuition credits do you offer for me to go continue being mm-hmm. like developing myself as a professional?
Yeah.
Like, there is a fine line between I'm not going to be here in 5 years or 2 years and I want you to keep me here. So that means you have to do something for me that isn't just raises, but is
yeah.
helping me develop my skills and talents so that yeah. I have a path forward.
Also, my least favorite interview question of all time is like, where do you want to be in 5 years? Because
right.
my answer has been different every single time because it's just like,
my answer is different every
who
day.
Who knows?
Right?
Like, how do you know that kind of
right,
shit?
Like, even just inside of Waypoint, like, where do we want to be in 10 years?
God.
Good question. We'll figure it out along the
know.
Way. We have a bunch of options and
yeah.
we will do what Rob said, which is follow them, follow, you know, dedicate ourselves to one, follow and see what else opens
yeah.
up. But like, there's a famous thing that's said internally advice, and I will let you talk, Rob. Rob is like itching to talk, which is you can do anything here. Don't try to do everything or else you won't get anything done. But you could
yeah.
do anything. You just have to find that thing and then.
Yeah, don't. Austin, dear Austin Walker,
uh-huh.
don't try to do everything.
I do
not
everything.
That you don't not that
it's,
you don't get anything mm-hmm. done, but
uh-huh.
you are you absolutely need to take that advice.
I know. Rob, what's
No,
what's
I'm
up?
Just gonna let Danica riff on maybe it just feels like maybe this
no,
is
Rob,
conversation
like,
to be had about that.
I'd
Austin.
Like to toss to you now. No, it's fine.
Just going back to this letter real quick, I have absolutely so my girlfriend's little brother a couple years ago was absolutely going to the equivalent of Burnout U. And he was in this place mm-hmm. where he was like, what the fuck am I doing with my life? Like, what am I doing in this place? I'm not sure mm-hmm. I'm learning anything here. It's going to cost a lot of money. It's going to cost the family a lot of money. And I'm just phoning it in. And he was on the ledge. And I was sort of told, like, by everyone in the family, like, hey, could you just tell him, like, encourage him to stick it out? Because, like, he really mm-hmm. needs to get this degree so he can go to college and not end up stuck in a shitty job. All the stuff, you know, all the stuff you say, like, this is why you need to go to college and all this. So I take him out, and we're sitting in this hotel lobby. He's having this visit with us, and I take him out. And I give him the pitch. Like, he's telling me all this stuff. And as he's telling me, like, what's going on at the school, by the way, the more I'm thinking, like, oh shit, he does kind of, this sounds kind of stupid. Like, what? This doesn't sound like a great program. Mm-hmm. But
right,
I tell him, like, stick it out. Like, you just got to stick it out. You'll write it out, and that'll open some doors for you. Go get your college degree, and then you don't have to deal with this bullshit, and you'll have all these options. He was like, cool, yeah, you're right. Yeah, I'll definitely try that. He did not try that. He politely listened and completely bailed out of the program and sort of plunged into the unknown to do mm-hmm. what? And it turns out I was completely full of shit. And everyone in the family was utterly wrong about what he needed to do next and what the best thing for his life direction was going to be. Like, at this point, like, he's got a really, really successful business, like, building, like, doing Twitch production and stuff, but not, like, for Twitch. He's, right. like, an independent contractor. And he makes more money than I do. He, like, instantly became, like, a really successful producer and a really knowledgeable one. And it turns out he was the best judge of, like, what his talents were capable of doing right. for him. And there's always going to be someone older and more responsible who's going to come in and say, like, look, I know this sucks, but you just got to swallow your medicine and pay your student loans.
Right.
And sometimes they're just fucking wrong. And if it doesn't feel right, you just gotta go with the direction that does.
Mm-hmm. 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 Totally. I think that's, like, roll with it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to hit one more little one, and then we'll wrap. We're going a little long today, but not that long. So this comes in from Jonathan, who says, thanks to the crew for all your hard work. The podcast is one of the consistent little joys that keeps me grounded. When I was in college a few years ago, I drunk texted a friend about starting a podcast and a website about games. Although my friend has always wanted a place in games media, for me it's always been a pretty fun hobby. It was fun to brainstorm the things we wanted to talk about, writing articles, streaming, and so on. We kept this up for about a year before we moved on to other things. After that year of work, we'd peaked at about 15 YouTube subscribers and a whopping 33 Twitter followers. After a few months, it became clear, to me at least, that our takes weren't interesting enough or presented well enough to stand out in the crowded field that is gaming content. My question is, what value do you think there is in creating content that nobody is seeing? Are there any reasons you might recommend creating content to someone who doesn't necessarily foresee or desire a career in it? I figured that, as professionals, you might have experienced times when you were figuratively speaking to an empty room. Did you get anything out of that experience beyond a stepping stone for your present career? Jonathan. Yeah, I got a lot out of it, right? But, like, that might sound easy for me to say from here, but, like, the first post I wrote on Clockwork Worlds, which was my old blog where I wrote about games, was about Bientôt L'été, the game from... God, what did they just made last year? They made that game about being a maid in a fictional South American
republic. Shit.
Oh, my God. What is the name of that developer?
Telltale.
They had that whole blow up. Tale of Tales. My first blog question was about that. Let me tell you, Bientôt L'été is a game in which you walk around on a French beach. No, you walk around a holographic simulation of a French beach while you're inside of cryogenic sleep in a spaceship, and then you, like, go into a cafe that's on the beach, mm-hmm. and you use words that you picked up from the waves to flirt, but also kind of, like, insult somebody across the internet and play chess, but you're not really playing chess. You're just kind of moving things around on a table.
Okay.
It's like...
This is a lot to take in.
It's like a new wave cinema, like, okay. Very...
Art.
You know, alt. Very art game, right. I love that game. Dad was writing that for me and four other people. Like, don't get it twisted. I knew that from the jump, right? Like, when I wrote about Christine Love's Even Cowgirls Bleed, like, I know the audience for that is very small. Mm-hmm. Not that Christine Love doesn't have great fans, but at the time it was like, you know, she had done some other games, but, like, this is a little side Twine game she had made. Not a lot of people are going to read this. For me, there is expressivity is its own joy. Like, yep. Making something, it does provide value for me. I don't sleep as well ever as when I have written a thing that day and put it out into the world, mm-hmm. whether or not someone reads it. Like, even if it's a piece that does poorly, even if it's a piece that I don't think is perfect, mm-hmm. I still sleep like a fucking baby the night mm-hmm. that I actually get to write something. And the thing there for me is just, like, if you're getting enjoyment out of making a thing and you have time to do it, it's fine for that to be your hobby. Like, let that be your hobby. Don't reduce all creativity in your life down to, does this get me money or fans, or yeah. is there a career path here? So that's, like, my first big thing. But what about y'all? Is that, like, a thing? Do you have creative outlets like that you do Because there is a difference between, like, I run Friends of the Table, tabletop role-playing game, podcast. We could just be playing those games internally, but I am putting them out into the world. And there is a distinction there. So I don't want to pretend, like, all that, like, doing that privately is the same as doing it publicly. So there is a distinction between those two things. But I think that whether or not you're successful, if you recognize it as a hobby and not a career, I think that that's valuable. Do you have any side projects like that?
Like my music? I definitely don't look at my music as something that's, like, career, like, of any type of career focus for me. It's very this has been a hobby of mine since I was a child. I haven't really had an opportunity to actually, like, make music until recently, so I'm just doing it. If a song does poorly, I get a little bummed, I guess. Because it's like I am putting time into it, but I'm not going to stop doing it just because of that.
Rob, do you have any side gigs, side hustles, side non-jobs that are still creating
interests? Well, I'm probably lacking in those right now. Like, to the point it's a problem. Like, I used to do a lot more recreational writing. Right. And then I was a freelancer for 10 years, and if I was going to write something, I was going to get paid. So I'm probably feeling that lack a little bit. Like, I'm on Three Moves Ahead. I host, like, this podcast about strategy games. Right. Still feels pretty work adjacent. What I'm not doing what I was doing, like, 10, 15 years ago was, like, trying to write novels and, you know, that kind of thing. And I used to do that pretty regularly. And nobody ever saw that stuff because, boy, like, the third act, it's just really fucking hard, guys. It's really difficult. So I've got a lot of partially written novels that no one's ever going to see. And I'm probably not going to go back to. But I think there's...
Were those valuable for you? Did you enjoy the time you spent writing them? Do you regret it at all that you spent the time writing them given that you didn't finish? Or are you glad that you wrote them?
There's only one I regret not finishing. But I am glad I wrote all of them, including the ones that are dog shit. And most of them were.
Right.
And part of it was none of that was going to find an audience, but it helped make me a writer. It helped develop me as a writer. Yes. Like, it developed me as a creator. And so there was
the things, a note that I give writers all the time, and I gave this as a teacher as much as an editor, is don't be afraid to cut things because feeling like you're wasted them. Sometimes the things that you write that you end up cutting are like bridges to get you to the final piece. And I hope it sounds like you feel the same way about the novels that you started to write, Rob. We're like, hey, they did something for me, even if no one ever reads them.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the one thing is that don't get precious about the stuff that you've kept to yourself, and you, like, always be aware that when you put that stuff out there, it's going to be like people are going to react to it and they're going to have opinions of it. Like, there's that too. Like, when you do put the stuff out there, you have to be prepared for criticism and rejection. And so I think there's the stuff you keep to yourself, I think, serves two purposes. One is that it can sort of train you up, but it can also just be an outlet that you need.
Yeah.
It's very different once you start making that available. Even if it doesn't find an audience, it's very different once you are putting it out there, whether that's just like showing it around to your creative writing classmates or to the world at large.
And I'll say just before we wrap up here, the thing about doing something for an audience or like conceptualizing it as a thing you're making versus just doing it, there's a difference there. Even if what you say is this is just a hobby, that can be really rewarding if you let yourself, quote unquote, like be professional about it or be more organized about it. So
definitely.
To Jonathan, who's like making YouTube streams, doing YouTube streams with his friend and like putting up podcasts, like, yeah, you could just play games with your friend. You could just have a conversation. And if those are still rewarding for you, do those things. But there is something different about saying like, ooh, like you're almost playing at something when you're like, ooh, okay, we're going to structure this podcast. In the first segment, we're going to talk about this. In the second segment, we'll talk about this. And we're going to do a break to shout out this other thing we like. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a form of almost like role play. At least it was for me when I first started doing this stuff as side projects. Was like, all right, how do I shape a podcast in which we play tabletop role playing games? Like, what's that sound like? Yeah. Well, you know, we have 200 people listening to us total. But I'm still interested in the structure of this thing as a media thing, and not just as there happened to be a tape recorder in the room. Mm-hmm. And if you enjoy that, keep enjoying it. Keep doing it.
And also, just being creative in general is going to open up other like parts of that creative brain that let you create stuff different. Like making music, I feel helps me with my writing, or making a plan to make like a YouTube video will help me in some way be motivated to create music. I think it's just beneficial all around. Yeah,
I think it's important to do these creative things, regardless of whether or not they're going to be. Again, the job will not save you, and I want to live in a world where we're not necessarily always looking for our hobbies to save us financially either. We should be allowed to play and let that be its own thing. So, all right, if you have questions, you can send them to gaming at vice.com. That's correct,
gamingadvice.com.
Make sure you use question in the subject.
Yep.
Danica, where can people find us on the internet?
People can find us at twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice, instagram.com/waypointvice, Tumblr is waypointvice.
We're on Tumblr.
We're on Tumblr, yeah. Wow. I posted about our playlist. Hey, you can find the music that we're listening to on Apple Music and on Spotify. If you search Waypoint's Weekly Rhythm Action, that's our weekly playlist. It's updated every week, new songs in rotation. Be sure to listen to those. We have some Kendrick.
Bangers.
Yeah,
in there
we have some good stuff on there. And you can find me on Twitter at Danica Herod.
Rob, where can people find you on the internet?
They can find me at Twitter, at Rob Zachney.
At Twitter, at Rob Zachney.
Somebody else. I think it might be that Jack guy. I don't know. Twitter.com/Rob Zachney. There you go.
And where can people listen to Three Moves Ahead, which you mentioned?
ThreeMovesAhead.net.
There it is. And I'm Austin Walker. You can find me at Austin_Walker on Twitter. Austin Walker Games on Facebook is the same thing as the Twitter, but if you're not on Twitter, you can go to Austin Walker Games on Facebook. I'm getting really quiet now. Shout out to Tim Barnes, who you can find on Twitter at TimBarnes451, our podcast producer. Shout out to Dylan Coburn. Shout outs to Bowen, who lets us use the track
Miss You
off of the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. It doesn't work if you go to waypoint.vice.com/BOEN. That's not how URLs work.
That's not how it works.
I own waypoint.zone, and I added a thing where you go /BOEN. It'll work. I don't know if that'll work if you go to poplyopals.moe/BOEN. I bet it won't work. I don't think it'll work if you go to culturalmarxism.club/BOEN. I don't think it'll work.
I forgot we have culturalmarxism.club.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll work if you go to bastionfucks.com.
Yeah. And also, what's the dot biz or something?
There's a dot biz now.
We have a lot of stuff. We have a lot of stuff. Lots of things.
Lots of big rings.
Shout outs
to everybody. We're going to do a couple more streams this week. Obviously, permadeath will happen. I'm going to put up votes for new difficulty modifiers in permadeath. I still have 2 lives left. I haven't lost a life in a long time.
Please lose a life.
I'm good.
I'm waiting for you to lose a life. I need it to happen.
I fought a big old stone person, and I beat him.
I'm being on the stream this week.
All right, you can be on the
stream. I'll make it a little bit more tough. We also have a very special, we're going to be premiering an album this month from one of our good pals on Weird Twitter.
That's true.
Can't tell you yet, but I'll tell you soon. And that person will be here on Wednesday to premiere a song. And
On Facebook Live.
Cool. And on Friday, we're going to be doing a stream with the Creators Project. We're going to be attempting to stream the new Rick and Morty VR game.
We'll see if that can happen in here.
We're going to move the couch out. We're going to go all out. I'll move it out personally.
Damn.
I'm strong.
That's going to do it for us this week. On that note, Danica Strong. Catch you next week. Catch you Friday. Peace.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.